Good afternoon, and welcome back to the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Kevin Barrett, Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays, and Jim Fetzer, the middle 3 days of the work week. But today you have the pleasure of listening to the guest host, Morgan Reynolds, sitting in for Jim Fetzer, as well as for tomorrow's show. Now, Monday was President's Day. Some people enjoyed a day off, probably didn't think much about presidents, but I have unofficially decreed this to be President's Week. Abraham Lincoln's birthday was back on February 12 last week, and George Washington's birthday is coming up Friday. And I have, under this theme, two more great guests after we spoke with Alan Stang yesterday lined up. We're going to discuss the presidents, if not honor them. And we also, of course, have a presidential election year, so we can finish out with contemporary politics. But we've got presidents. Do we have any great ones? Well, we've got mediocre, we've got abysmal, and then we've got the out-and-out traitors. And yesterday I had a teach-in with Alan Stang. Today we have a professor of economics, Thomas J. DiLorenzo, from Loyola College in Baltimore, Maryland. And I'll introduce him very quickly here. He is a Lincoln scholar, among other claims to fame. And then tomorrow I've got author Jim Mars, who is, among other things, an expert on JFK and the assassination, which has come recently into the news the last few days. We're going to discuss the current crop of presidential candidates, but H.L. Mencken, I noticed, is the sage, known as the sage of Baltimore. He said, democracy is the theory that the common people know what they want and deserve to get it, good and hard. He also, Mencken, of course, is just a treasure house of quotations and blunt insights. Mencken said that every decent man is ashamed of the government he lives under, and I think Tom might concur with the sage of Baltimore. Maybe Tom's our living new neo-sage of Baltimore. Tom has a Ph.D. from Virginia Tech. He is a really great guy, great dry sense of humor. It's a pleasure to have Tom DiLorenzo on the show. How are you, Tom?
Morgan, I'm very well, and thanks for the introduction.
Yeah, I noticed Loyola College, I looked at that. They are a Jesuit school. I went to a Jesuit high school, Marquette University High School, that went secular thereafter at the University of Wisconsin. You seem to be able to delve into any controversial topic you want without any restraints. How is your situation at Loyola College?
Yes, I do. One of the things I've learned about the Jesuits is they've been in the education business for several hundred years, and they have a lot of regard for academic freedom, and they take it very seriously. And I am the most politically incorrect person on the faculty. And I think you were when you were at Texas A&M, probably, most likely. But they leave me alone. You and I have both heard horror stories about discrimination against people who think a little differently than the politically correct regime, but I have pretty much complete freedom to. They've even given me a couple of research awards.
Yeah, and Tom is a prolific author. You're 10 books or more now?
I think I'm on number 13 now. I just have one coming out in the fall called Hamilton's Curse, about the political and economic legacy of Alexander Hamilton.
Well, that takes us to the very good. That takes us to the president, and the conventional wisdom, the historical establishment, if you will, the political science consensus is that the three great presidents are Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, Honest Abe is number one very consistently. And then it's a contest for two and three between George Washington and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now, what would your ranking of those three be?
I'd keep Washington up there near the top, since he was sort of the chief executive officer of a very tiny bureaucracy, which is what the presidency was originally intended to be. It wasn't intended to be a dictator of the world like it is today.
I know that somebody just said, Tom, that Washington's War Department had 18 employees.
I think so. When he and Hamilton tried to put down the so-called Whiskey Rebellion, the Whiskey Tax Rebellion in Pennsylvania, they had to have Congress pass a special law to allow conscription of men in the mid-Atlantic states to go with them. They didn't have a standing army. So, you know, based on that, I'd keep Washington up near the top, but I'd put Lincoln dead last and FDR right next to him.
Yeah, I noticed. Now, Tom had two articles in this wonderful volume edited by John V. Denson that came out of the Ludwig von Mises Institute called Reassessing the Presidency, subtitled The Rise of the Executive State and the Decline of Freedom. And our colleagues in the economics trade, Vedder Galloway, had an article in which they did their own ranking based simply on alleged changes in spending as a percentage of GDP, as I recall. And they came up with the same proposition you just enunciated. Namely, you'd put the Lincoln and FDR at the very bottom of the rankings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not only for that reason, but, you know, I've written two books on Lincoln, and one of the things I found out is the average American just knows a few slogans about Lincoln, and that's it. They really don't know anything else much more than that. There are exceptions, of course. But when you think about it, he invaded his own country. It was one of the first things he did when he became president. And as I point out in my books, every other country in the world that ended slavery, including the northern United States, New England, Pennsylvania, and so forth, did so peacefully without a war. They figured out a way to pragmatically get rid of the institution of slavery. And also, Americans need to know that the invasion, the original invasion of the southern states, had nothing to do with freeing the slaves. Lincoln himself, you just need to read his first inaugural address, where he pledged his support for a constitutional amendment that was called the Corwin Amendment that already passed the House and the Senate that would have forbidden the federal government from ever interfering with southern slavery. So that wasn't the point. So he waged war on his own people and ends up killing about 350,000 southerners, micromanaging a war that did that. For what? To prove that the Union was not voluntary. And up to that point, most Americans believed that, well, of course the Union was voluntary. The states, the individual states, ratified the Constitution by state conventions. And
were required to do so. What was it, 9 of 13 were required to ratify the Constitution originally?
Yes, 9 of 13. And that fact actually is in the Constitution. You know, how the Constitution itself is to be ratified is by the citizens of the states. And so he essentially waged a war that killed 350,000 fellow citizens just to prove himself right, even though his history would indicate that he was dead wrong on that. The Union was a voluntary union, but he destroyed that union when the dust settled because the Union was no longer voluntary.
He clearly was an important president, one of the two most important. And we're going to come back after the other side of the break and learn more about Lincoln and other presidents from Tom DiLorenzo. Today and tomorrow you have Morgan Reynolds as your guest host. And my guest today, here to talk about President's Day, President's Week, and look back on history and how important it is. I noted yesterday on the program that Henry Ford, our famous auto industrialist, the man who put America on wheels, is often quoted as saying, "History is bunk." Now, on one level, yeah, it's just the anti-intellectual, practical man of affairs spouting off. But if we put an adjective there, Tom DiLorenzo, in front of it, we could say conventional history is bunk. And Tom DiLorenzo is the living proof, the guy who's proving that so much of our Disneyfied history is about 180 degrees from the truth. And I got to reminisce. I think the first time we met, Tom, was back at a maybe it was the 10th anniversary. There was a banquet done by the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. And Tom then was a young assistant professor at George Mason, weren't you?
Either an assistant or an associate, something like that.
Let's see. I think that must have been around 84 or somewhere in there. It's amazing how time slips on by. And here we are, older, and actually, I think, a little wiser about this. And Tom is also an adjunct scholar with the Mises Institute. And I want to go to this next segment by saying that he did a book called The Real Lincoln by Thomas J. DiLorenzo. The subtitle is A New Look at Abraham Lincoln, His Agenda and an Unnecessary War. And before the break, you were talking about that. But let me play devil's advocate here and claim that, oh, wait a minute, the South fired the first shot. They were the aggressor. And I've got a, I'm here on page 121 of Tom's book, The Real Lincoln, and in a speech to Congress on July 4th of all days, 1861, Lincoln had the audacity to say, writes DiLorenzo, with regard to the Fort Sumter incident, that, quote, having thus chosen our course, without guile and with pure purpose, let us renew our trust in God and go forward without fear and with manly hearts. Was this honest Abe in action once again telling us the truth?
Yeah, he was a silver-tongued devil in that regard. I also quote Lincoln writing a letter to his naval commander, Gustavus Fox, thanking him for helping him to manipulate the South Carolinians into firing the first shot on Fort Sumter and giving him an excuse to go to war. And, of course, no one was hurt, let alone killed, at Fort Sumter, and Lincoln responded with a full-scale invasion of all the southern states, not just South Carolina, that ended up killing, as I said, 350,000 people and essentially destroying the country for many, many years.
He created an empire. Instead of a federal constitutional republic that was originally established by this in the form of the central government, a federal republic, he consolidated it, didn't he? I mean, it was just a matter of time playing out that it was a unitary state.
Yeah, I'm not the first one to point out that really, when it comes down to it, what the war was about was the original argument that took place between Jefferson and Hamilton at the time of the founding on whether we would have a voluntary union that was highly decentralized, whereby the states delegated a few specific powers to the central government, mostly for war and foreign policy, or will we have the type of system that Hamilton wanted. He wanted a king, a permanent president with all power vested in the central government that could appoint all the governors and veto all state legislation, an empire. And
I didn't know he was that bad, Tom.
At the Constitutional Convention, Hamilton laid out his plan. And by the way, the convention was his idea. He lobbied for 7 years to get a convention to supposedly revise the Articles of Confederation. And the first thing they did when they got there was to scrap them entirely. But he wanted a permanent president who would appoint all the governors and who would have veto power over all state legislation, so that the states would have just been like have as much power as they had in England prior.
Right.
To the
just administrative subunits, really, of the central state, right?
That's right, and that is essentially, of course, what we've got now. And it was Lincoln, more than any other man, that created this. This gigantic centralized bureaucracy. He created the Internal Revenue bureaucracy, and he proved once and for all that anyone who dissents against the central state will be the victim of the wrath of the central state in terms of the military invasion. The state of California decided to secede.
So it's
today.
Really, what we have is kind of a mafia arrangement where the only way you can opt out is in some kind of a casket, or at least it's going to come to a force of arms, right? If you one of the states said, "Hey, I want out," like Kosovo has seceded from Serbia. Nobody seems
right.
too upset about it.
No. Even the U.S. government today actually supports it because they'll be an ally and they'll help expand the American empire in Europe. But they're generally against any kind of secession movement. It's a bad signal. They don't want to send a signal that they would tolerate something like that, to be sure. But that's I call Lincoln the founding father of big government in America. He more than anybody else ushered in the big centralized tyrannical state that we all slave under today. We had the first income tax, first federal military conscription ever, the first waging of total war by an American army.
Funny money. You know, no more precious metals as the money.
Right, the National Currency Act.
He suspended the habeas corpus and a lot of civil liberties, of course. He had one of those congressmen arrested. What was his name, Pellingham?
You know, Clement Vallandigham was a congressman from Ohio.
Vallandigham.
And the Republican Party gerrymandered him out of his seat. He's a Democrat from Ohio. You still there?
Yes.
Okay. And he went back home to run for governor of Ohio, and he was making speeches objecting to the suspension of habeas corpus. He was arrested and deported. He ended up in Canada. So
that's our hero, our civil liberties hero, Abraham Lincoln. We'll learn more. We need to stay on Lincoln for another segment. On the other side of the break, more from Tom DiLorenzo. But I am here today as your guest host, Morgan Reynolds. I am interviewing Tom DiLorenzo. He knows something about the tax man as an economist. And tomorrow I will have author Jim Mars. And one of the arguments, Tom, let's see if you agree with this wisdom, I think, that has emerged on our side of the aisle, namely that secession, which was commonly understood as a right of the states, the sovereign states, the right to secede in the future for good reason, none or bad, was commonly understood. And isn't that the kind of the ultimate discipline of over abuses by the central state as opposed to these three branches, a constitution specifying limited powers and these other devices that seem to be penetrated or are thrown overboard so easily? Isn't secession a powerful disciplinary mechanism?
That was always the idea, because otherwise the question of how the Constitution is to be enforced has the answer of, well, by the government itself, by the central government itself. And the idea of the Jeffersonians was that if we're going to have this Constitution that delegates limited powers to the central government, then we, the people, have to have a very important say in how it is to be enforced. And what that means is that if this government ever becomes destructive of our fundamental rights, which is the whole purpose of the government, to protect our rights to life, liberty, and property, if it ever changes and becomes destructive of that, then we certainly have a right to abolish that government and institute a new one. That's what Jefferson said in the Declaration. And Jefferson himself, of course, was the author of our Declaration of Secession, known as the Declaration of Independence. And he even wrote, later on in his life, he wrote letters, private letters to people saying that, if the western part of the country and the northern part and the southern part wanted to split or separate, they would all be our children, and he wished them well. But he understood that they would be doing that because they thought that the government was no longer protecting their rights. And that's why after Jefferson was elected president in 1800, the New England Federalists spent 14 years plotting to secede. And it culminated with a secession convention in Hartford, Connecticut. And they decided against it, but no one ever questioned their right to leave the Union. and a lot of abolitionists also.
Some of the New England states refuse to send militia or abide by conscription in the War of 1812, so it was an effective, in effect, a secessionary move by them?
Right, yeah. In the War of 1812, the New England essentially refused to participate. They thought it was an unconstitutional war. They said they thought it was just a dispute between Jefferson's party and the British, and they would do such things as if a man were called to be in the army, they would put him in debtor's prison on phony charges, and then as soon as the federal agents would leave, they would let him out of jail, that sort of thing. And so they effectively seceded.
That's an interesting kind of ruse. Now, I want to revisit. Lincoln seems to gain a lot of this idolatry by virtue of freeing the slaves, and African-American voters for many years were part of the Republican vote count. But if the Lincoln had not invaded the South and tried to suppress this secession, on behalf of the Union, the sacred Union, what would have happened to slavery as the peculiar institution? Wouldn't it have fallen of its own inherent infirmities anyway and peacefully?
Well, I argue in my books that it would have, but not only that, but the government, a real statesman, could have made it happen much quicker, because the federal government subsidized slavery with something that was called the Fugitive Slave Act. It was a federal law that essentially conscripted Northerners to run down runaway slaves and return them to their owners. And, of course, once the Southern states seceded, that law became invalid. They were no longer part of the United States government. And so a slave in Virginia, if he could escape into Pennsylvania, would be free forever. Whereas under the Lincoln regime, at the outset of the war, there was still a bounty on the slave's head if he escaped because of the Fugitive Slave Act. And so if they had gotten rid of that successfully, I think certainly slavery would have, that's how slavery ended in places like Brazil. It ended peacefully. But our statesmen could have sped the whole process up. England did it, according to one book written by a Nobel Prize winner in economics, Robert Fogel. It took them 6 years to peacefully end slavery in the British Empire once they really decided they were going to do it. And I don't see why Americans couldn't have done the same thing.
Right. This was the most costly termination of slavery, which really wasn't what it was about, essentially, anyway.
Yeah, the slaves were essentially used as political pawns in a war that was about the consolidation of political power. And the African Americans are still being used as political pawns, as is many other ethnic groups in America.
My guest yesterday, Alan Stang, you can read him at alanstang.com, made the case that the Republican Party was always red state, red literally, because the Marxist, the communist revolution in Europe failed in 1848, and we were the proud recipients of many hundreds, if not thousands, who fled here. And they liked Lincoln, this whole kind of statist thing. So he makes the case that really it's not the Republicans, will say some good words occasionally on the stump about free enterprise and low taxes, cutting taxes, and limiting the government expenditures, and on, but they rarely seem to behave that way. Is there something fatally flawed, and just based on the origins of the Republican Party, and is Lincoln more representative of what Republicans are really about?
Well, I've written quite a few articles on the internet in the past couple of years, saying that the party of Lincoln is really finally in power now, the Republican Party of today, with this idea of a global crusade for democracy, of waging war in a number of countries in the name of some abstract theory. For example, Newt Gingrich published an article in the Wall Street Journal online 2 years ago advocating that the United States invade and occupy Iran, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, and Syria, and North Korea. And the title of the article was Lincoln and Bush. He was saying Bush should do what Lincoln would do and go on this global crusade for this abstract principle of forcing democracy on people. And, of course, you know, Lincoln's famous Gettysburg Address and his speeches when he talked about supposedly the purpose of the war was so that a government of the people and by the people would prevail. It's the same thing. It's the same rhetoric. But they've always been about empire, militarism, inflationism, and corporate welfare.
I recall an article by Murray Rothbard, Invade the World. And I think he started out by saying it's hard to mock or ridicule these people because that's what they're really saying. Okay, we will be back after the break with more talk about the presidents with Tom DiLorenzo. But today, I'm Morgan Reynolds and sitting in for Jim Fetzer, as well as tomorrow. Tomorrow, my guest will be author Jim Mars, a prolific writer on JFK, 9/11, and lots of other interesting topics. Today my guest is Professor Tom DiLorenzo of Loyola College in Baltimore, Maryland, and we've been talking about spending a good deal of time on what the establishment calls our greatest president, Abraham Lincoln, and Tom rates him the worst, and I second that idea. Let's go to the actually when we left on the other side of the break, Tom was saying that the Republicans seem to have this bent, this ambition for empire. So the Bush-Cheney regime really isn't out of character, but is more a fulfillment. Do you want to add anything on that topic? Because next I want to move on to briefly at least treat George Washington.
To put it into historical perspective, the Republican Party of today and most of its history has been the party of Hamilton. And as I said earlier, the big battle, the political battle between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson was one where Hamilton took the position that the American government should be an empire with highly centralized power and essentially a king, a permanent president. The Jeffersonians said, wait a minute, we just fought a revolution against that kind of system.
Right, and, it sounds like Europe moved west across the
pond.
Right,
and it was always linked to economics. It was Hamilton understood that the British mercantilist system, which was basically a system of policies that benefited politically connected businesses at the expense of everyone else, was not a bad system if you were on the receiving end of it. If you're on the paying end, it's bad news. But if you're the person in charge, it's very good news. You become very wealthy as well as powerful. And that has always been the modus operandi of the Republican Party from the very beginning, and we certainly see that today.
So the
party of Hamilton.
The left critics are at least right in a certain respect here, and that is, hey, the Republicans are all about corporate America and big money.
That's right. Even even Ronald Reagan, the most conservative or libertarian president of my lifetime, he was only really effective for about two and a half years, and then he really didn't do much from our perspective. It was very good after that. And but besides that, when has there been a limited government conservative president who's a Republican? Even Eisenhower wasn't that great, as far as that is concerned.
Okay, Eisenhower, of course, is at least part of his fame and general approval of his presidential years rests on his farewell address, and that takes me to George Washington. And you were pretty kind to Washington when it came up earlier in the program, but of course we have the people on our side of the aisle who, like Murray Rothbard, did a piece where he said, hey, in effect, George Washington wasn't that much of a general. He committed so many blunders. And Rothbard held him accountable really for not for turning a kind of a free man volunteer army more perhaps suited for guerrilla warfare. but a very egalitarian, free man type arrangement into a traditional hierarchical top-down command system with the very distinct differences between officers and enlisted men, etc. So that was one charge, which, of course, not everybody's going to embrace as wrong. But Washington did some good things. For example, two terms, no king. His farewell address, of course, warned against entangling alliances, but wasn't Washington ideologically really very much more on the Hamilton side of the argument, the Alexander Hamilton centralizer?
Yes, he was. He was a Federalist, after all, and Hamilton was his Secretary of Treasury. And one of the momentous occasions of his administration was when Hamilton proposed a bank run by politicians in the nation's capital to be called the Bank of the United States, and Jefferson was dead set against it, and they both debated the issue with big, long reports that were sent to Washington, and Washington accepted Hamilton's position, but it wasn't totally ideological. Part of what happened was Washington wanted the nation's capital to be moved to Washington, you know, D.C., Virginia, eventually. Part of the deal was the Federalists who wanted this bank said, we will extend the boundary of Washington, D.C. right to be adjacent to Mount Vernon if you sign off on this bank that we want. And that's what convinced George Washington to not veto the legislation for the Bank of the United States.
That sounds like a kind of a cheap bribe to me.
Yeah, well, he was a politician at that point, and the politicians act like politicians when you put them in office. Who would have ever thought? Even George Washington.
Even George
Even Thomas
Washington.
Jefferson.
Okay, well, let's skip a whole bunch of time here and go the other side of Abraham Lincoln chronologically to our third greatest president, or sometimes ranked second. He and Washington are depends on the poll, but that is one Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now, Roosevelt,
yeah,
of course, is also very important. Certainly he passes that test, really establishing, just for establishing the welfare state, the origins of the national federal welfare state in America, as well as World War II. So where should we put, I guess this is the bottom line, but let's put it up top. Where does Roosevelt rank, in your opinion, among the presidents?
I'd rank him near the bottom also, as far as that's concerned. You know, as you know, Morgan, after the whole 1930s, the whole decade of the 1930s, with the Great Depression, the unemployment rate, the official government statistics on unemployment was still, what, around 13 or 14% in
1930. Still
double digit. Mm-hmm. Whereas it was down around, you know, 3% in 1929. That was sort of the normal rate. And so what FDR did basically was make the Great Depression longer and more severe with his policies. And the First New Deal, as they call it, essentially tried to create cartels by government-enforced cartels in agriculture and manufacturing with the National Recovery Act and the Agricultural Adjustment Act, both of which were ruled unconstitutional in 1935. But he had the idea that high prices would save us from the Depression because low prices caused the Depression. Therefore, if we could force prices up by law, we'd all get rich. And that didn't really work out that way.
And it can't, we know, as economists.
It can't.
Right.
And then the second New Deal was
didn't figure that out. Go ahead, Tom.
And then the so-called second New Deal was a lot of policies that essentially drove up the price of labor and made it more expensive to hire people with minimum wage laws and laws that strengthened unions, and that created even more unemployment in the second New Deal, and unemployment insurance, taxes, and so forth. And so he basically ignored elementary economics and destroyed the economy by doing so. all the while blaming it all on capitalism.
And yet, historians and political scientists say that Roosevelt saved capitalism. And
yeah,
what you're pointing out
propaganda.
Is propaganda. It's amazing. It's like the treason of the intellectuals. There's our break sign. Beatles ushering us off stage. We'll be back with more from Tom DiLorenzo on the other side of the break. Today I am speaking with Professor Tom DiLorenzo. And where did we leave off? FDR. Often called one of the best, greatest presidents of all time. Consistently the establishment puts FDR as the second or third greatest president, where the mix includes Lincoln as consistent number one and George Washington among the top three. Well, Professor DiLorenzo has an article called Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal, From Economic Fascism to Pork Barrel Politics. And Tom, you were pointing out that all this intervention, wrong-headed as it was, never did get the U.S. economy out of this deepest depression and longest live depression in U.S. Economic history. And two thoughts for you. One is, you mentioned that this economic fascism was the formation of these industrial cartels trying to boost prices as if low prices were the cause of the depression, rather than the market self-correcting to new conditions. But you have another article called Lincoln and the Triumph of Mercantilism. When you said cartels, it sounded to me like Republican economic policies rather than FDR, of course, a Democrat. Isn't there a lot of similarity here in the two parties?
Well, yeah, there sure was. In fact, they're both very Hamiltonian inspired in terms of having a close relationship between business and government. And whenever there's a close relationship between business and government, it's time to put your hand on your wallet and or put it in a safe someplace. But these cartels, you mean, what could be better? Suspending the antitrust laws and propping up prices above market levels with the force of government behind you. Why wouldn't big business like that? And even though FDR's rhetoric was very harshly anti-business, at the same time, his actual policies, at least in the first couple of years, were sort of a continuation of what went on in World War One, where the hundreds of industries were involved in military contracting, and they essentially named their own price for all the things that were supplied to the government. And that sort of arrangement, I think, was carried over to the New Deal. And in fact, many of the same people who worked in the government during World War One became New Dealers under Roosevelt. And so they put this same kind of rotten system of government-enforced monopoly into place, and it just made the Great Depression worse and longer-lasting.
Yeah, that, of course, then harks back to Woodrow Wilson, who's consistently rated among the top half dozen, right around six, as in greatness of the presidents, and he was a complete disaster in every respect, domestic and especially foreign.
Yeah. Well, I'd recommend to all your listeners the book called Wilson's War by Jim Powell. That really is a great book about Woodrow Wilson. And, Wilson, he was a progressive, and the progressives were statists. And so in terms of his economics, it was all thoroughly interventionist and statist. And he got us into the World War One unnecessarily. It was a dispute among the European monarchs that had nothing to do with us. But as you know, he went on a crusade to make democracy safe for the world. And the book by Jim Powell argues that Wilson was the very worst president because our intervention in World War One, Powell argues, ended up strengthening the hand of both the Nazis in Germany and eventually the communists in Russia. And that was not a good thing to do. And I can't get into it in a short time here, but I would recommend Powell's book, Wilson's War, if anyone wants to read up on just how that...
Oh, yeah, that the Great War. Even the historians have a piece of the truth right there. What a disaster it was, and it led to the 140 million dead in the 20th century. Here's a quote. Now, Tom is a professor at Loyola College in Baltimore, Maryland. Can't restrain myself here. Got to quote the sage of Baltimore again, H.L. Mencken, who says, and I quote, "Under democracy, one party always devotes its chief energies to trying to prove that the other party is unfit to rule, and both commonly succeed and are right." Isn't that what we've just demonstrated? And our two major parties have consistently given us a disastrous heads of the executive branch.
Right. Yeah, my good friend Lou Rockwell, who you know, Morgan, wrote a paper once making the case that every American president has been worse than his predecessor. And he goes right down the list and gives reasons why everyone's worse than the guy who came before.
Well, I guess I'd have to see the evidence that Thomas Jefferson was worse. He was our number three president, wasn't he? Numerically, chronologically.
Yeah, he was third, but he was, you know, he became a politician and he behaved like a politician. He imposed an embargo on all trade. The best thing you can say about that was it avoided getting into another war with England at that time. The England were kidnapping American sailors and confiscating American ships as a part of their war with France. And Jefferson didn't know what to do, so he imposed a trade embargo on it, which was devastating to New England shipping industry, for example. And the Louisiana Purchase was of dubious constitutionality. So even when you get the great Thomas Jefferson in politics, he acts like a politician, just like George Washington did when he got into politics.
Now, this principle, we'll call it that, of separation of church and state, it's not put that way in the Constitution, but that's kind of the modern version, seems to have a big hold on the electorate and much of our officialdom. And yet, you know, the way Ayn Rand put it was she wanted the analogous thing here where you have a separation of state and economy. And that doesn't seem to have any traction at all.
No, it doesn't. I guess, you know, just out of pure self-interest, there are too many people who do too well to buy with state favors. And as you know, Morgan, any business or industry that does well by state favors, protectionism or so forth, usually uses some of that money to hire well-paid propagandists to help keep the system going, to miseducate the public, telling them that high prices are really in your best interest, Mr. and Mrs. Consumer, and things like that. Then you've got the academics who are, so many of whom are court historians who simply props for the state.
Yeah, molding opinion. That goes to that expression again, the treason of the intellectuals, and they play a powerful role in keeping what are bad people in office and electing newly worse people, I guess, according to Lou Rockwell. My guest today is Professor Tom DiLorenzo, an incredibly knowledgeable man about the history of the U.S., probably the world. Most economists seem to spend their time doing lots of mathematical gymnastics and computer work, working with these huge numerical databases. So, Tom, where did you go wrong learning all this history?
Well, I was influenced by the Austrian School of Economics and people like Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek, who thought that really if you're going to call yourself an economist, knowing economics and math is just part of it, that you really ought to understand something about history and political philosophy if you want to understand the economic world really well. And I've always looked at them and sort of students of theirs like Murray Rothbard as role models. And besides that, they seem to be having a lot more fun than our colleagues in the economics profession who are just sort of slaves to mathematics and work on what an old friend of mine used to call exquisite trivia. They pick trivial questions to study, and it all looks very technological and very exquisite, but it really is trivia. And so,
it apes physics, and there's no question that the econ tribe is full of bright people, but what a boring bunch.
Yeah, an old friend of mine, who's a fellow economist, tells a joke. He said he was at an economics convention in New Orleans, and a prostitute came out of the hotel just as he did and said, "Hey, well, what are you doing in town?" He said, "I'm at an economics convention." And he says the prostitute just turned around and walked off.
No sales pitch, huh?
Yeah. If it's an economist, not only are they boring, they're very cheap, too. And so,
on the other side of the break, we were lamenting the state of the political parties and the inability to appreciate the where progress really comes from. They mistakenly believe it comes from all these government interventions, welfare programs, and these interventions, of course, overseas, not just domestically. But I recall, maybe you can help me with this quote, it was Adam Smith who said, in effect, that there's a lot of rot in the land, but there's this enormous resiliency, too, this silent, invisible hand, the coordinating function of the market, and then the daily effort of each individual to try to improve his or her own material condition. That's not very elegant, but it's that comes from Adam Smith. So that's where the real my guest yesterday, Alan Stang, was saying is what we want is a do-nothing government, because most of it, they rarely undo their bad interventions.
Yeah.
But we want do-something people. That's where the heart of the progress all come from.
That's right. That's the saving grace of our economic world, despite all its efforts to destroy the economy with its interventions. We still have, in a big country like ours, many thousands of entrepreneurs who are working very hard day and night to get rich by providing us good stuff, cheap.
Yes.
It's actually a store in Boston where I have relatives, and that's the sign on the front, big, gigantic sign, good stuff, cheap. And I guess it could be called Walmart. You know, I tell people Walmart has done more for poor people than all the government programs in the history of the world has done for poor people by cutting prices on groceries and things like that. But that's one of the things that keeps me.
What is their reputation as a result of this enormously successful engine of prosperity for low and middle income people? What do they get for it? They're the bad guys, right? That's the image.
That's right. Yeah, there's my friend Tom Woods, who's a historian. He's the author of this big-selling book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. He has this Woods's theory that anybody who does great things for the poor will become a pariah, whether it's Walmart or whoever it is. As long as it's a private institution, then the statist of the world will attack that institution as an enemy of the public.
Yeah, even though you're doing good deeds, of course it's mutual profit, but it's punished almost immediately. Well, let me point out to you that one of your articles here in the Denson volume, which is on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, I want to spend a few more minutes on Roosevelt since he is defines the modern welfare state and interventionist war overseas, etc. You point out, you said you're somewhat of an expert on the subject of government lies. So I wanted to get your insight on what happened at Pearl Harbor. World War One hung over the American public as shows what a disaster interfering in European wars was. The America wanted nothing of this resumption or continuation of war in Europe in 1939, 40, 41. And along comes, lo and behold, Pearl Harbor. What was FDR's role in Pearl Harbor?
It was another Fort Sumter, wasn't it? I did my article. In my article, I don't really cite the book Day of Deceit that it was published some years ago. That
2000, Robert Stinnett.
Robert Stinnett provided a very compelling argument, complete with evidence from the National Archives, including original letters and documents from Roosevelt himself, that he manipulated the Japanese into attacking Pearl Harbor, and he knew about it in advance. And when I read that book, I was convinced that Roosevelt did manipulate the Japanese into attacking Pearl Harbor, and that he did know about it in advance. And he thought it was for the greater good. And Stinnett himself was a World War II veteran. And even though he proves this pretty satisfactorily, he says it was a good thing because he agreed with Roosevelt that we needed to get into World War II. And so, that's the big debatable point. But this is the kind of thing that most Americans, I think, won't swallow. But the evidence, it really hits you in the face. It's really
it is. It's very compelling. And the establishment originally maintained Roosevelt, though he knew nothing about it, he was a complete innocent. Now they do what Stinnett says. Well, we had to drag America into it because public opinion was so firmly against involvement in another war in Europe. We will be back after the break with more great insights from Tom DiLorenzo. And my guest today is Tom DiLorenzo, a famous Lincoln scholar, as well as quite a powerful economist and writer, prolific. And tomorrow my guest will be author Jim Mars, who's an expert on the Kennedy assassination as well as 9/11. So, Tom, here we're going to move into recent history. The 9/11 event has been called the New Pearl Harbor. It was called it that day. And one of the suspicious things surrounding 9/11 is that this group of so-called neoconservatives, the Project for the New American Century, put out this document exactly 12 months earlier in September of 2000 to re-examine America's defense priorities and, in effect, foreign policies. And there's a famous sentence in there which I can only paraphrase. I was looking for it but didn't locate it during the break, and that is they pointed out that all these wonderful new military programs and global domination, they didn't use the term global domination, but the projection of American power and preeminence globally could only be attained with some kind of catalyzing event that would awaken the American people for the need of these defense expenditures. So my question to you is, you're an expert on, somewhat of an expert, you say, on government lying. So is the government lying about what happened on 9/11?
Well, I co-authored a book called Official Lies, How Washington Misleads Us. I guess that makes me a bit of an expert, but I'm certainly not an expert on 9/11. I think Ron Paul said that it was a case of gross incompetence, and it certainly was at least that. All my life I've been told that the FBI and the CIA and the military and the Air Force were out there protecting me, and that there were airplanes circling the East Coast in case there was ever an invasion 24 hours a day. And here you have luxury liners, slow-moving luxury liners, kidnapped by terrorists that lumber along from Boston to New York. And where the heck was the Air Force? Was the first thing I said.
Yeah, taking a circuitous, kind of a leisurely route, roundabout.
So...
None of these were, these four alleged airliners were intercepted, according to the official account. And one of the many, many problems with the government account is that it was 1 hour and 6 minutes before supposedly this fourth airliner was hijacked. After the first was allegedly hijacked, that was the American Airlines Flight 11 that supposedly flew into the North Tower. So this, yeah, gross incompetence maybe isn't sufficient to describe this kind of, wow, is this a whopper or what? You expect me to believe that? You know. Interceptions were routine. You know, they would have roughly 100 a year where planes are out of channel. They're out of their flight path and are incommunicado. You need to put somebody up there and find out what's going on. Yeah. Interception does not mean a shoot down right away.
Right. Yeah, that's one of these things where I don't know, but it certainly does sound fishy that... were they really that incompetent? I would think that, you know, I live in Baltimore where Dick Cheney has just built a big house on the eastern shore of Maryland, and I've read that fighter jets have intercepted, like, some guy in a little Cessna who flew over Cheney's house by accident over on the eastern shore of Maryland, and you know, they didn't waste their time doing that. They got there right away, and they forced this guy down. And here's a big ocean liner sized jet, jumbo jet, cruising along over to New York City, and they couldn't catch up with it. It sounds awfully fishy to me, but I don't know.
Let's go to the current presidential politics, since I have decreed this to be President's Week, and we're in an election year for the presidency. Now, two issues are going to weigh and already weigh large here, and I want to get your take on the economy and then the war, which primarily means the war in Iraq rather than Afghanistan and possible future wars like attacking Iran. What about the economy? Where are we? Are we in danger of some kind of a deep and long recession? The financial sector looks awful shaky. We've had quite a boom, maybe some bubbles. What's going on? What's the situation?
Yeah, well, I'm not a soothsayer, but you know, all the news that we keep getting day in and day out seems to be bad, and I'm amazed that the stock market is still as high as it is, as far as that's concerned. And I think we will have a recession, and that'll probably guarantee that a Democrat will be elected president in the fall if we plunge deeper into a recession.
I think the Democrats, they say don't go by primary votes, which are a small number compared to the general election, but the Democrats are almost 2-1, attracting almost twice as many votes. So there's some excitement on the Democratic side.
Yeah, and of course the Democrats who control Congress will probably do whatever they can to sabotage the economy, like, you know, raise taxes and regulations if they can, if they can get away with it, or at least veto any good policies that President Bush might actually at the last minute proposed that would be helpful to at least a couple of industries and big industries in the economy. They don't want that to happen, and so they'll veto anything good.
Bad news is good news, right? At least until the votes are cast.
That's right.
Somehow
that's,
counted.
Yeah, that's another thing that you and I know about that maybe your listeners don't. Is there's something in economics called the political business cycle, whereby politicians try to manipulate the economy with monetary and fiscal policy and regulatory policy to work to their advantage in election time, and they actually create more instability by doing that rather than less in the economy.
Now, Tom, in the past, you have participated, I believe, in some campaigns there in Maryland. That is, worked on behalf of some libertarian-oriented candidates or freedom-oriented candidates. Are you still doing that, or what's your situation?
I sort of gave up in Maryland. I tried to help out Ellen Sowerbrey when she ran for governor in the early 90s, in the mid-90s. She ran twice and lost, but in the second time there were all sorts of fishy behavior, like more people voting for her opponent than existed in a voting district and things like that, and she actually sued the election commission over this, but lost, of course. But I've sort of given up on Maryland politics. It's a one-party state.
With this alleged corruption, that didn't have anything to do with electronic voting machines, Diebold.
No, this was before that. This was before right. that. It was just old-fashioned sort of Chicago-style crookedness of where there would be a voting district would be in a high-rise downtown, and there'd be 200 people living there and 300 votes registered for her opponent. Things like that.
2004 presidential vote counting.
Yeah.
We will be back after the break with more on presidential politics with Tom DiLorenzo. My special guest is Tom DiLorenzo, a professor of economics at Loyola College in Baltimore, Maryland. Tomorrow my guest will be author Jim Mars. Well, Tom, let's turn to the contemporary candidates here for president. That's my theme. It's President's Week, so let's take it right up to the present. And I want to get your thumbnail comments on the major candidates on both sides of the aisle, as well as the possibilities to speculate about a third-party candidacy, because I don't think any of these are candidates, or, well, maybe Obama. But what about Ms. Clinton?
Well, Hillary was a socialist in college. She was a socialist all her life. She was in the Carter administration. She was the head of the Legal Services Corporation, which did all kind of crazy things like suing the state of Montana to use state tax dollars to finance sex change operations. That was how she cut her teeth in politics. And, she wanted to nationalize health care when she came in. Here, her husband got elected. She still wants to nationalize health care. And I don't think Obama is any different than her in any significant way. So we've got two socialists on that side. And then,
but Obama gives a better speech, I guess. He's more inspirational, right? Barack.
That's what they say, yeah.
It looks like he's going to be the candidate right now, unless something dramatic changes for the Democrats. I guess they could run together, but a lot of animosity built up. Okay, what about on the Republican side? Is it John McCain or McWhorter there? And then we got Mike Huckster. We've got Dr. No, Ron Paul.
Yeah, well, of course, as you probably know, I've been a big supporter of my old friend Ron Paul for a long time. But he was all over the media until the voting started. The media needed something to talk about, and he's the only one that's not singing the same old sorry song like all the rest are. But as soon as the voting started, there was a complete, total media blackout of Ron Paul. He hadn't seen him anywhere. And right now, of course, it looks like McCain, which is kind of scary on economics. He admits that he knows next to nothing, but he said recently, "But I have Greenspan's book." So Greenspan is—he's who got us into the current mess that we're in now.
The age
of turbulence. Promising. And
mm-hmm.
He talks like Napoleon, like he wants to invade the world and start a 100-year war somewhere. And so I think he'll scare a lot of people, which will guarantee a Democrat will be elected.
Yeah, I have an aged uncle who said about George W. Bush, and my uncle's a gun owner, you know, states' rights, every kind of good right-wing opinion, and he said, well, at least Bush killed the Republican Party.
Yeah.
But I guess Bush-Cheney, you've taught us today, really embody the traditional Republican big government party.
Yeah, they're the sons and daughters of Lincoln, for sure. Well, Bush 1 wasn't exactly a conservative either. He was a big government guy. And so, you know, where is this limited government Republican Party at? Like I said, I can think of a couple years in the Reagan administration at the beginning that were very good from my perspective. And I know some of the people, as you do, like Jim Miller, who was at the Federal Trade Commission and the Budget Office, who were good.
Yeah,
people
are policy. Remember that slogan. Yeah, you need good people, dedicated, ideologically more or less sound, to really weather the storm and pursue these quasi-revolutionary changes.
But then the so-called neocons took over. They are relentless networkers and politickers. And, you know, there are most of them, the older ones, are former leftists. Some of them are former communists. They call themselves, they say they were Trotskyites in their youth. And they've pretty much taken over the Republican Party and the Wall Street Journal editorial board and all the magazines and National Review. And they are not at all like the people in the early Reagan administration who were more Johnsonians.
And I cannot read the Wall Street Journal editorial page anymore. I used to read it every day.
Yeah, they used to publish me all the time, but they quit about 10 years ago when the neocons took over, and I couldn't get anything published, not even a letter, once they took over.
Yeah, it's now, what are the chances? Now, the Democrats are going to keep a lock on Congress. There's just no chances there of overturning the Democrats in a majority. They're well fixed here to win the presidency, probably Hussein Obama. What about a third party, though, candidacy? Could that turn this presidential selection process upside down? Ron Paul denies he would run as a third party candidate, but conditions seem ripe for it.
Yeah, there is the Constitution Party that was, you know, one of the founders was my old friend Howard Phillips, and he would be the perfect candidate for the Constitution Party if he were to run. But I think Americans are we are a nation of sheep. You know, my friend Judge Andrew Napolitano, who is on the Fox News Channel and is their legal expert and has written a number of really great books about the Constitution.
I've noticed that. How can this guy stay on Fox? He is so good.
Yeah. Well, a friend of mine who knows him told me that Roger Ailes is an old family friend, and Roger Ailes runs the Fox News Channel. And so even though he's a libertarian and he's sort of poisoned to Bill O'Reilly and all the rest on the Fox News Channel, his job is solid there. But his latest book is called A Nation of Sheep, and I think I'm afraid that's what we've become. So I don't have high hopes that a third party candidacy of Ron Paul or anybody else would succeed.
Yeah, it's a shame. And now the corporate media have shrunk through agglomeration to what, five companies or basically generate 90% plus of the national and international news for Americans.
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, how the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law has enabled McCain to get the nomination because, you know, it makes it very difficult, if not illegal, for ordinary people to pool their money and put political ads on. And so what that does is really strengthen the hand of the so-called mainstream media, the Rush Limbaughs of the world and the Fox News channels and the New York Times and all that. And they really call the shots. And as I mentioned earlier, look how they have censored Ron Paul ever since the New Hampshire primary. They don't want anyone to challenge the status quo. And that's one of the evil effects, I think, of this campaign finance law that McCain put through. And he is actually going to benefit from it. He's going to be the nominee.
He's benefiting from his own legislation.
It destroys competition in politics.
Right. Yeah, I was chief economist in the U.S. Department of Labor in the first Bush term from 2002 to 2003. And I was holding my breath during this whole period about when would they start really doing some bad things. I didn't know anything about 9/11 involvement, but I was too naive then. But when Bush signed that McCain-Feingold campaign, and he signed it like at 6 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah.
And it was almost a secret signing.
Yeah.
And that was absolutely anti-freedom, anti-free speech. I mean, it should have been struck down by now, you would think, legal challenges by a decent Supreme Court. And here is McCain may be elected president because of this as an important factor.
Yes,
just
I agree.
Awful. Yeah. Well, thank you, Tom DiLorenzo, for some very informative conversation about the presidents. And I wish you well. Keep it up, my good man. Great stuff from Tom DiLorenzo at Loyola College in Baltimore, Maryland. Tomorrow, my guest on the Dynamic Duo, author Jim Mars. We'll talk JFK, 9/11, and more.